You're listening to Admitting Diagnosis, the Journal Watch podcast for the week ending September 26th. I'm Joe Elia. What we attempt here is to offer a brief roundup of the week's essential medical news, the stuff important enough to write on the back of your hand, plus an interview. In this week's, the week the presidential candidates are supposed to debate foreign policy, we talked with Dr. Stephen Hetz about his contribution to a book on war surgery in Afghanistan and Iraq. If you'd like to leave us a comment, and we do want to hear from you, call 617-440-4374. Links for everything we discuss are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. All right. Here are the week's four essential medical stories very briefly. Alteplase treatment for stroke now has a wider window if needed. Continuous glucose monitoring in pregnancy helps babies. Maternal influenza vaccination offers some protection for infants. And drug-eluting stents seem superior. Now for the details. Fibrinolytic therapy for stroke should happen within a three-hour window. Now, that window is widened somewhat for late arrivals, according to an article in the New England Journal of Medicine. A randomized study of some 800 late-to-treatment patients who received alteplase or placebo 3 to 4.5 hours after symptom onset showed a higher likelihood for favorable outcomes at 90 days among alteplase recipients. An editorialist reminds everyone that these findings aren't an invitation to dilly-dallying, as they say. And in Journal Watch Emergency Medicine, J. Stephen Bohan writes that these results, taken together with those published earlier this month in Lancet, signal what he calls an immediate change in practice. Next, glucose monitoring in diabetic mothers makes a difference, especially in the late stages of pregnancy. In a smallish study published in BMJ, 70 diabetic women, type 1 or type 2, early in their pregnancy, were randomized to either continuous glucose monitoring with implantable devices or to usual care. After week 32, hemoglobin A1C levels were significantly lower among those on monitors. And at delivery, birth weight and the incidence of macrosomia were both lower in the women on monitoring. Next, speaking of helping babies, vaccinating their mothers against influenza during the third trimester helped prevent febrile respiratory illness in both infant and mom. A study published in NEJM concludes that the number needed to treat to avoid one case of febrile respiratory illness in infant or mother is 5. In Journal Watch Pediatrics, Peggy Sue Weintraub recommends vaccinating pregnant women when they show up at the office in fall or early winter. In Journal Watch General Medicine, Howard Bachner reminds everyone that the vaccine's efficacy varies from year to year, depending on its match with the circulating strain. Finally this week, stents. A prospective study in NEJM finds that 2-year mortality rates among those receiving drug-eluting stents for acute myocardial infarction were lower than those with bare metal stents. The drug-eluting stents also were associated with a lower risk for recurrent revascularization. That's this week's news. Here is the Journal Watch interview. This summer, the Surgeon General's office published a book entitled simply, War Surgery in Afghanistan and Iraq, A Series of Cases, 2003 to 2007. The book, available from the Government Printing Office, seeks to document the medical and surgical lessons learned in those wars so far, and to prepare clinicians for service on or near the battlefields. War surgery profoundly illustrates what modern weapons can do to the human body, and what modern surgical techniques can do to attempt to repair the damage. We've asked one of the authors of War Surgery, Dr. Stephen Hetz, to talk with us about the book. Dr. Hetz is a surgeon and a retired colonel with 30 years' service in the Army. He has served in Panama, Somalia, and Iraq in both conflicts there. Dr. Hetz is now director of medical education at the William Beaumont Army Medical Center in El Paso. Welcome, Dr. Hetz, and thank you for talking with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Tell us about the idea for this book and how you went about collecting all those 80 or so cases you included.
Sure. Actually, I'm, as it says in the book, I'm one of three editors. Sean Nesson is the first editor. Actually, Sean is a general surgeon who graduated from my training program. I was the general surgery program director at William Beaumont Army Medical Center in El Paso when Sean did his training there. Sean also has deployed to the Iraq theater of war, and actually since this book, in the middle of this book, also was in Afghanistan for a 15-month period of time. But Sean returned from Iraq and was really interested in trying to, you know, find more information about some of the things he'd done and how, you know, he could do them better, perhaps. And he actually was talking with Dave Lounsbury, who is the second editor. Dave is an internal medicine doctor who also had deployed to Iraq with the 10th Combat Support Hospital. And, you know, apparently the way it went was Dave told Sean, hey, if you want a book like that, you're going to have to make it yourself. And they gave me a call. I had been deployed in 2004, and basically I had been interested in a similar book. We had published a book earlier. This book was called Emergency War Surgery, which was an update of a book that's been published several times by the United States Army about war surgery. But it's basically a book of prose and, you know, some diagrams and, as we like to call them in medicine these days, cartoons and schematic drawings. But really, there is nothing that really prepared one for the reality of some of the injuries that I really experienced for the first time in Iraq. And so they gave me a call and said, are you interested in helping us do this? And I was very interested, actually, in doing that.
I see that many of the photographs in the book, you actually mentioned, I think, in the introduction, that many of those were taken by the surgeons in the middle of, or people who were present in the middle of those operations as the people came in.
Yeah, basically, all the clinical photos are taken that way. There are no professional photographers that participated in those particular photographs. Now, there are other photographs in the book that were taken actually by professional photographers, you know, notably the cover picture.
Yes.
But frankly, what surgeons did, because of the great availability, obviously, now of digital cameras, not so available back in the first Gulf War, but now they're ubiquitous. And
yeah.
Frankly, people documented many of their cases, and I must admit, I was very interested in doing that. Having been to several other combat theaters and experiences, I just never really took the time, and I thought later what a great educational tool this would be for residents, especially general surgery residents, that would be deployed possibly in the future. So when I was deployed, I took great meticulous care to try to document many of the cases I did. I had, you know, nurses in the operating room or other physicians take pictures while we did these cases, and I wasn't the only one. And so a call went out basically to military surgeons, specifically Army general surgeons, but we solicited some from the Air Force as well. We were fortunate to get some. We asked for cases, if they had documented cases of an experience in, you know, any venue, whether extremity, chest, head, abdominal injuries, and if they had what they thought were pretty well-documented cases to send them in to us. And we sifted through a bunch of these cases and came up with these 83. Plus, in the margins, you can see we have little additional cases with some interesting vignettes about those kind of cases, and assembled those with the narrative description given and put it in this format that the book carries of talking about the case, you know, the teaching points, you know, a lot of the lessons learned, and things that we might have done different, too. So.
It does read paradoxically like a textbook, although as a reader, it's difficult to separate yourself from the experience of the patients who are being operated on and what the trauma and your realization of the trauma they've just been through. And then you see the teaching points at the end of all this. And I was going over this in preparation for talking with you, and I was glad to see that most of the cases included were successfully treated. There's a picture of a fellow there with his wife 5 months after his serious injury, and he's smiling.
Right. Right.
One of the reasons he's smiling, I think, is that he's with his wife. But he seems happy and healthy. One of the things that struck me today, the new New Yorker has just come out, and in it is a portfolio of photographs about service and military service, and as well as a profile of a fellow who had PTSD and ended up dead with his brother. Is there And PTSD, of course, is not a surgically treatable wound, but it's a wound nonetheless. And is there a lot of that that's being seen? And are there ways of treating it that are improving?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. Obviously, I'm a general surgeon, and this book is largely focused on surgical cases. But in fact, of course, post-traumatic stress disorder, well known from Vietnam, is also well known in this war. I mean, quite honestly, some of the horrendous injuries that soldiers and others experience, as well as witness, are just, I think, just too difficult to handle sometimes. And what ends up happening is they do, when they come back from the war, they have some difficulties at home. And frankly, the Army and the military in general has been very, very concerned and interested. I mean, all of these soldiers, before they deploy and after they return, fill out pretty extensive questionnaires in their post-deployment debriefing.
Yes.
About, what experiences they've had, if they've actually seen somebody shot or killed or suffered a wound themselves. And, these are put into a database, and these soldiers are followed fairly closely. There's great concern within the Army among the chain of command. That is, the company commanders, the battalion commanders, the platoon leaders, the platoon sergeants, the first sergeants, all the leadership, to kind of keep an eye on people when they get back to see if they are, in fact, displaying erratic behavior or behavior that may be indicative of post-traumatic stress, and then try to get them the necessary help to do that. In addition, the Veterans Administration has been extremely tuned into the post-traumatic stress disorder problem with veterans, and frankly, I think has done a lot to try to, mitigate the difficulties. But quite honestly, it's a very difficult problem to treat.
Yes.
It truly is.
Well, you went through West Point and then the Uniformed Services Medical School. Did any of that prepare you for practice near the battlefields?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, very much during medical school. I went to a medical school that was training future Army, Navy, and Air Force physicians, and we did a lot of, we had lots of classes on military history, on the history of surgery, military medicine. I mean, truly, the history of medicine, especially surgery, is military directly related. So much of it was learned on the battlefield, from the earliest times to now. And so there was a lot of attempted preparation, but frankly, the pictures that you see in this book really, you can tell those pictures are pretty graphic and really show some pretty devastating injuries.
Yes.
Seeing those up close and personal is even a step beyond that, quite honestly. But as a surgeon, we do trauma. General surgeons do trauma a lot, and frankly, you see a lot of traumatic injuries. Often, it's very rare to see an injury in civilian practice that is of this caliber, but it does occur. And frankly, dealing with that kind of stuff teaches you and trains you to deal with the priorities to save that life when that patient comes in with those injuries. And, kind of after it's over with, you get a chance to kind of look back and go, wow, that was something else. But during the actual episode of care, you're just focusing on those things necessary to keep that patient alive. His airway, stop the bleeding, control the contamination, and try to preserve life, limb, and function as much as possible.
What surprised you most as a combat surgeon?
Yeah, I got to say that I think that there are several things, honestly. First of all, the way the medical people that I work with in my hospital responded and took care of these soldiers was just beyond remarkable, in my opinion. The average medic, nurse, other people that work inside the hospital, they just did an extremely professional and incredibly, intense experience. They just did a great job at managing these types of injuries day after day after day. We took care of everybody, of course. We took care of Iraqi civilians. We took care of enemy insurgents, all of the above. I mean, they all were part of the war wounded, and we took care of them day in and day out, and the people did a remarkable job doing that. And the second thing is, it really was remarkable. I mean, almost to an individual, the soldiers would come in with sometimes very devastating injuries, lower extremity injuries, like, they lose their leg below their knee, they lost their arm or something.
Yes.
Like that. And their questions were always virtually the same. They wanted to know how their buddies were. And the second thing they want to know is how soon would they be able to return to their unit. to get back to what they were doing.
Surprising.
I mean, it just was astounding and took us aback. And it was like, yeah, well, let's just get you better. Then we'll worry about that stuff later.
No.
But I mean, to me, it was astounding to see that their level of interest and concern was to get back to the people they had just been with, so they could continue working with them and working together to keep each other safe and do what they need to do. It was pretty. I don't know how to really describe it. It was pretty amazing.
It was a pretty unique experience.
Yeah.
Well, many of those wounded people that you describe in this book and others, of course, will be seeking care in non-Veterans Administration hospitals over the coming years. What can you tell those attending to those people to help them with their care?
Yeah, I'm not sure I can tell them anything they don't really already know, and that is that basically, you know, you look at these people that have, I think, sacrificed so much, you know, for their country and service to the country. I think, as every patient, you know, they deserve a lot of respect for what they did. And really, you know, when any patient's treated with respect, I think they do much better in the care with those physicians. I mean, frankly, the other issue is, I think this post-traumatic stress issue is a significant one. And anybody that's been combat wounded or has had, you know, this intense combat experience with whatever illness they might have as a result of that, you know, that's something that always has to be in the back of the physician's mind is, you know, other than the physical malady that you're looking at, let's say it's an amputation or whatever kind of injury, you know, an old head injury or something, that, you know, the overlay of this post-traumatic stress disorder is going to be around somewhere, and they just have to think about that and consider that as part of the treatment paradigm for that patient.
There's a foreword by Bob Woodward, the journalist who is the NBC journalist, I believe, who was wounded.
Actually, his name is Woodruff.
Did I say Woodward?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I meant to say
Bob
Woodruff. Yes. And he says that, you know, not only is the immediate care important, but the longer-term care in his foreword. You know, the sort of the kind of wounds that don't heal, and he says that the care given in the heat of the moment is wonderful, but he says he hopes that the system will find its way to figuring out how to give that kind of excellent care as the life of that soldier continues in the years that follow. Is that spoken from somebody, do you think, who's experiencing that sort of continuing problem with a wound?
Well, I mean, I think certainly. I mean, if you read the description in the book of his wound, and you know, his wife and he published a book that I actually read not too long ago. I think the name of the book is In an Instant, and it really catalogs his injury and then his recovery from that injury, which is a pretty amazing story. When you get right down to that, the truth is that story is being repeated on many occasions in Iraq and back here in the United States. And it's hard. It's very difficult because, you know, it's true, and as he says in the book, in those white-hot moments of the injury, I mean, you got the whole combat support hospital, every medical person just focused on that problem. And then eventually, you know, the acute problem is resolved or has been resolved enough to be able to get back to some semblance of a life. And then, you know, the concern as well will be forgotten. And honestly, you know, the Army, and I know the Veterans Administration, is very committed to that not occurring, quite honestly. You know, recently, you may or may not know, the VA had a change of leadership. The Secretary of the VA is retired General Jim Peek. Dr. Peek was the Surgeon General of the Army for 4 years back when I was still on active duty. And, you know, he's a phenomenal individual, and quite honestly, I think as a former combat infantry officer and as a surgeon as well, he is the perfect guy to really be able to, you know, clearly understand the issues. You know, he himself was in Vietnam, and after he came back from Vietnam as an infantry officer, decided to go to medical school. So the VA is really going to carry a lot of the ball on these lifelong issues that many of the soldiers and both retired as well as soldiers that just served there several years and got out are going to, you know, need attention for over the ensuing decades. And I think it's, I think the focus and the interest and the mandate to care for these individuals over time is there.
They certainly deserve it. You begin the book with a quote from Hippocrates, and the quote is, "He who would become a surgeon, therefore, should join the army and follow it." And you've done that. And then you and your co-authors and your co-editors ended with a quote from with a poem from Wordsworth, but then an intriguing quote from Virgil's Aeneid about the tears of Aeneas as he struggles with the memory of war and lost friends and comrades. Was your journey similar to Aeneas?
Well, I have to tell you, you know, Dave Lounsbury is the second editor of Listener. Dave is just a delightful guy. You know, he's an internist and a neurologist, and kind of, you know, Dave wasn't really the guy who would do the technical aspects of surgery. I mean, you know, Dr. Nesson's a general surgeon, I'm a general surgeon, so the two of us really, you know, pounded out the details about if this was the right thing to do, what was the teaching point about this. But when it comes to, you know, the structure, the style, the kind of ambiance that the book exudes, I mean, that was really all Dave. And those quotes, of course, were largely gotten by Dave because, frankly, you know, to him, this book, you know, we didn't really talk about the purpose of the book. Really, what it came down to the purpose of the book was we really saw this as a bridge from a book like the Emergency War Surgery Handbook, you know, which is schematics and prose and whatever,
yes,
to reality. This is the bridge to reality. Now, you know, it's not reality because it's pictures, but this is as close to reality as you get without being there. And, you know, and really that was our interest, was to have surgeons, specifically military surgeons that were going to go to war, have some preparation for what they're going to enter. I think Dave really saw a larger purpose for the book, and I think, you know, those quotes at the beginning and the end, which really are, you know, of his discovery, I mean, he found them, put them in there, and they kind of fit in the book there, kind of tell a larger story, you know what I mean,
yes,
in terms of, you know, the fact is when you're young and excited, you know, the war is some kind of a new adventure, but the truth is, war is a lot of suffering, that's what it is. I mean, and that's reality. You know, whether you agree with the concept of being in the war or not is really not the issue. I mean, truthfully, it's a lot of suffering, and, you know, making that decision to embark on, you know, such an endeavor, it's a pretty weighty decision. But the thing that's amazing, of course, is, you know, you can see at the very beginning, we also dedicated the book to service.
Yes.
And, you know, it's the service of soldiers, Marines, airmen, sailors who have sacrificed so much for their country. And that truly, especially from us providers, medical care providers that took care of these people, it's truly from the heart, because it is quite a service and quite a sacrifice and commitment that lots of America's youth have given to this country.
Well, it seems a good point to end our conversation. I want to thank you, Dr. Hetz, for your service and for your time with us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Finally this week, speaking of things military, I recommend you find your way to the current New Yorker, the one with the cover showing a Wall Street exec stepping into an open manhole. The issue contains two items worth your time. The first, a photo essay entitled simply Service, and the second, a profile of post-traumatic stress disorder. It all seems relevant to our interview this week. As always, if you'd like to talk about any of this or anything else, call 617-440-4374. Just leave your name and number so I can get back to you and get your permission to put your comments on the podcast. Links for all stories and a collection of a dozen of these podcasts are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. Join us next week, won't you? Thank you for listening. For the Journal Watch podcast, I'm Joe Elia.